Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do border crossings shape life in the U.S. and Mexico? And do the laws and policies in place at international boundaries accurately reflect most travelers' intentions in crossing? Particularly since 9/11, much U.S. rhetoric has focused on the importance of safeguarding the border with Mexico, from would-be terrorists who might want to enter from the south, but also from members of foreign drug cartels and undocumented workers looking to fill American jobs. While acknowledging those concerns, my guest today says they give an incomplete picture of the reality of cross-border travel between Mexico and the United States, two countries that remain vital to one another's economies, and they ignore the fact that plenty of U.S. citizens facing criminal charges have headed south over the southern border to escape capture. Stephen W. Bender is professor of law at Seattle University School of Law. His new book is called Run for the Border: Vice and Virtue in U.S.-Mexico Border Crossings. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Welcome, Chris.
Perhaps you can start by talking about this unique symbiosis that's existed between the U.S. and Mexico for well over a century now. I realize we could spend an hour talking about this, but why do we need each other?
For the last 150 years, and that's the framework that I talk about in the book, we have been essentially economic and cultural partners. So I try and address so many of the crossings, not just by fugitives coming south, but by retirees buying homes in Mexico and the Mexican beaches, by second homeowners, by tourists. And I ask people to think about their border crossing. And the purpose is served, and I try and situate some of the more contentious, certainly is a word for it, border crossings, particularly by drug cartels and undocumented immigrants within this framework. And it's really a small percentage, a small number of millions and millions of crossings that are essential for commerce between the two countries.
It's really easy to overlook, at least for Americans, the ways that the U.S. and its citizens gain from this close proximity to Mexico. What's the source of that assumption on the U.S. side that all the benefits of cross-border travel go to Mexico?
I think it's because we sort of take for granted that we can be, you know, we can be sitting in Orange County over cocktails and maligning undocumented laborers who might have actually been cleaning the glasses after we're done, but then we can fly off for a weekend in Cabo or in Cancun for some sport fishing and not think twice about the prerogative we have to travel as we may, for our pleasure or to buy a second home or retire in Mexico for our economic benefit. But we're not really thinking about the dire economic pressures that cause undocumented immigrants to come across the border, at least did until the current downturn in the economy when their numbers seem to be coming to a halt.
You write that U.S. policy toward the Mexican border is driven chiefly by two types of border crossers, and you've already mentioned these, drug traffickers and migrant laborers. At what point did these individuals start to be the focus of border regulation?
I think in terms of immigration, I think immigrants became the focus of border policy when our immigration laws failed to keep up with demand. Mm-hmm. We always used to have, whether through bracero programs where laborers from Mexico and a pact between the U.S. government and Mexico came over in droves to save crops in the fields during World War II and beyond into the 50s and early 60s. And it was really only when we failed since 1986 to recognize a confluence of labor need and immigration that we've had such a focus on immigrants. And then there's also this perception that somehow the 9/11 terrorist events had something to do with lax security at the U.S. Borders, particularly the U.S.-Mexico border. So that's certainly ramped up an imperative of emphasis. And then the drug trade is its own complicated issue. As we've made inroads, both in the U.S., like with meth enforcement, and in Florida, say, and other routes for cocaine, there's been a use of Mexico and smuggling routes in Mexico. So there's been sort of a shifting and a refocusing of entry through that poor country into this rich, addicted country, addicted to cheap labor and illicit drugs.
The other thing that's easy for Americans to forget is that there was a time when there was very little enforcement along the southern border. People just sort of came and went and returned as they pleased.
There was, and there were very few impediments to lawful immigration crossing, aside from occasionally head taxes and some administrative paperwork. And it was just as easy to avoid that cost and come right on in. And in fact, there were very few border guards at the time, and they were charged with protecting the border from entrance and at times prohibition and the smuggling of alcohol and the smuggling of illicit drugs and even the smuggling of Chinese migrants at a time in the United States when Asian immigration was prohibited being smuggled in from Mexico.
Human trafficking remains a problem at the borders these days.
Absolutely. Sexual and labor trafficking north uses some of these same smuggling routes. And I think, or what I urge, is that if we concentrate and separate the really malicious and vice-driven crossings from crossings that stand to benefit us culturally and economically, maybe we can better focus law enforcement on those truly heinous crossings that do exist both north and south.
So talk a little bit about this, the idea that the southern border has been seen occasionally as a safe haven for U.S. felons looking to escape prosecution. How accurately can we account for Americans who head to Mexico to sort of disappear?
They're really small numbers, whether you're talking about Mexicans headed south as fugitives or U.S. residents headed south to blend in across the border. I mean, when you think about Run for the Border, you're thinking about fugitives, and Hollywood certainly does its part to boost that stereotype. But the numbers are really small in relation to the millions upon millions of legitimate commerce and tourism-based border crossings that happen every year. But those fugitives that do cross, there's been, you know, there have been some notable ones. And those tend to attract a great deal of attention because we don't care about a tourist crossing the border or a truck filled with goods destined for U.S. markets crossing the border. But if we hear about some fugitive that might be headed to Mexico or is intercepted south of the border, then that attracts a lot of media attention.
Steve, can you talk a little bit about the kinds of international cooperation that take place in order to apprehend and extradite felons on either side or just to simply allow these two governments to work together to get the bad guys?
Sure. In the case of intercepting fugitives, there are procedures in place and protocols in place that depend on whether it's a Mexican resident, Mexican national or not. But more often than not, those procedures have been subverted. And I think the most blatant example of that is the United States has actually even kidnapped from Mexico suspects, Mexican nationals involved in the drug trade. When the United States felt that Mexico wouldn't at the time with its administration be cooperative and willing to extradite those fugitives because it's optional for the Mexican government to decide whether or not to extradite a national. And say if I'm a U.S. resident and I commit some horrific crime in the United States and I run for the border and I'm running from a state like Texas that has a death penalty, Mexico for years hasn't recognized the death penalty and will refuse to extradite unless and until the local prosecutor says basically, I will refuse to seek the death penalty. And for a very brief period of time, a sentence of life without parole was deemed by Mexican authorities to sort of carry the same bar on extradition, but that finally gave way. And so now it's really if I were to face a death penalty charge, the Mexican government would tell the United States, no, we won't extradite Bender unless you agree to charge him without that possible penalty is how it works. But that could be kidnapped, as was actually done, as I mentioned, by U.S. authorities to sort of circumvent that prohibition. And it was in the case of a Mexican national doctor anyway. It was actually a very unique charge. It was a doctor whose criminal charge was he prolonged somebody's life to be tortured, to be tortured longer about information that person knew about U.S. Drug cartel enforcement. So it was quite a unique scenario.
So there are bad apples in pretty much every organization, but when we talk about cooperation with the Mexican side, we do hear, at least in this country, widespread reports of corruption within Mexican law enforcement systems. Can you talk about how accurate those perceptions are and how much we need to be worried about the ability of people to be bribed, for example, within Mexican law enforcement?
It is certainly a case that that there is widespread corruption in the Mexican government and also within the U.S. Border Patrol, because a number of crossings, whether of immigrants or of drugs, take place with complicity of U.S. Border officials. And it's hard to get an actual number other than the media attention that when somebody is found out. Usually they have too many nice cars, too many trips to Europe, and too big a house as a border official. But there is definitely corruption in the Mexican government, and that has, you know, that makes strategies to address the illicit border flows very difficult. But it also suggests that there's been a change in the case of drug enforcement away from what was a long-standing sort of standoff between, or gentleman's agreement, if you will, between the Mexican government and the cartels. The cartels operated in a corrupt system, and the Mexican government basically gave them the go-ahead to traffic marijuana so long as they behaved more like businessmen and less like thugs. When that deal was off, and Fox and Calderon, the current Mexican president, ramped up a federal war on the drug cartels, then, you know, the streets were bloodied and all of that was, you know, and we have to look at other solutions. But if anything, I argue that a return to the sort of corrupt system where innocent people don't die by the hundreds or thousands might be a short-term way to approach this, mindful that in terms of long-term solutions, corruption is never something to strive for.
Are local and federal police in Mexico, can they expect to earn a living wage on the job these days?
They can, although it would probably be the least likely job I'd want to undertake, because it's probably, you know, it's probably as dangerous a place to be a law enforcement officer or a journalist these days that you could imagine. In fact, photojournalists travel in groups in Ciudad Juarez for their own protection. Even if you can make a decent living, if you can imagine that you can basically retire 5 years early on a payoff to let one border load go through, and imagining that our entire U.S. drug supply and need, as substantial as it is, could be served by just a few freighter trucks filled to the brim with drugs. And that could tell you that there's a substantial impetus for, you know, for bribery in the system. And there'll always be people who are willing to be on the take.
Stephen W. Bender is my guest. He's professor of law at Seattle University School of Law. His new book is called Run for the Border, Vice and Virtue in U.S.-Mexico Border Crossings. We'll resume the conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Seattle University Professor of Law, Stephen W. Bender. He's author of the new book, Run for the Border, Vice and Virtue in U.S.-Mexico Border Crossings. You can be part of this conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Steve, I think you were approaching this as we took the break last time, but, you know, it's very easy to look across the border and say Mexico cannot get its cartels under control. There is all this violence. But the reality is, and you speak to this eloquently in the book, that industry exists because of great demand on the U.S. side of the border for these drugs.
It does. In 2010, the Mexican president, who actually has ramped up that fight on the cartels, did lament that it's like we're living next door to the biggest drug dealer in the world, or excuse me, drug user. In the world, drug addict, and that's true. Drug addictions have certainly not abated, and the U.S. is a voracious consumer of illicit drugs. And in the book, I argue we should be focusing a little less on interdiction and a little more on controlling demand in the United States, and I suggest some ways we might consider doing that. In the meantime, you know, thousands of people, many of them innocent, die yearly south of the border, while we continue to sort of reap the benefits, those illicit drug users, without really questioning the morality even of drug use.
So the first apex of the smuggling of goods from Mexico to the United States came during the prohibition of alcohol in the 1920s. What kind of cross-border criminal enterprises sprung up during that time, and what changed once prohibition was repealed?
Well, in the advent of prohibition, there were U.S. suppliers that were basically training their whole warehouse supplies south of the border, rather than, you know, face it being emptied in the U.S. side of the border. And so all of those enterprises, including a number of say, bars, tavern owners in El Paso, just simply crossed the border, brought their business to Ciudad Juarez, and south of the border was wet. It didn't change that with the advent of prohibition. It had already been legal for alcohol there. But there was definitely a trafficking across the border. A number of other countries sent alcohol to Mexico, and that booze was smuggled across the border. There were people in droves that went south of the border to party and be awash in alcohol. But there were also deliveries to regions far from the borders, speakeasies and otherwise. And it's interesting, when prohibition ended that great social experiment that was obviously a national disaster, and you see in the Super Bowl this year the Budweiser commercial that focuses on sort of how wonderful an achievement up there with space exploration that we ended prohibition, and how people feel about that now, and it sort of makes you wonder about are we really in the same? Are we in the same throes of a failed social experiment when we're trying to outlaw marijuana, and we have prisons full of drug offenders and spending billions upon billions, while the cartels just get rich in that economic chaos, and innocent people die? Is that really in the long-term best interest of both countries?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you? My question, and you've touched on a couple of these points, is putting either the practical or morality or moral issues aside, were marijuana only to be legalized tomorrow, what would the near-term and medium and long-term impacts on both sides of the border be?
There are not absolute figures, because a lot of the drug statistics are best guesses and speculation. But the speculation is that at least 60% of the Mexican cartel profits derive from the delivery of marijuana. So that would be, imagine a business losing 60% of its revenue stream. That would be a terrific impact that would allow us and enforcement agencies to really focus on other illicit drugs that, that we feel maybe are more harmful in society, particularly methamphetamine. So in that sense, it would have a very terrific impact. In terms of the United States, it could have an extreme revenue impact because you're talking about shifting enforcement resources toward addiction treatment resources. And you're also talking about a system like medicinal marijuana where you can tax like we sell alcohol, which would derive billions of U.S. dollars in revenues, and also really take an industry that I think is positioned and really illustrated over the years through Mexico that it can be run, at least in that country, in a corrupt system. It can almost be run as a business, and that you don't have in the Super Bowl people fighting each other on the streets. You have cute little commercials of Heineken and Budweiser squaring off in the Super Bowl.
But if we were to legalize marijuana and tax it, at an extent that we would feel appropriate, perhaps more heavily than we would tax other goods that come across the border, the fact that there is already a pretty robust distribution system illegally that would not require taxes, wouldn't that keep really a great incentive for the black market in marijuana to continue?
I think there's several reasons why that wouldn't be the case. If I'm purchasing a black market marijuana, I don't know if it's been paraquat sprayed like it was in the 70s. I don't know if it's ridden in, and I talk about this one interception in the book, it's ridden in a septic truck.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's been soaked in gasoline in order to elude drug sniffing dogs crossing the border. I think only as somebody who had the least conception of safety that I'd be willing to sort of know where it came from, and that it wasn't really the source of sort of a bloody black market. So I really think, like, look at alcohol. There may be a black market in the sense of somebody sharing their home brew with somebody else, but there really isn't, despite the significant taxation on the alcohol market. There really isn't this wholesale smuggling, and I think that the efficiencies of production and the costs of illicit production would just completely give way, and we would see the emergence of a legal market. And if there were remnants of an illicit market, like there is today, maybe in the sense of alcohol being provided to minors, although marijuana may be even more readily obtainable because it's smaller and easier to hide from your parents. But I think those are things that can be looked at. This is a work in progress, like our immigration policies. There is no silver bullet that solves any of this, to use an alcohol metaphor. All of these issues, these intractable seeming border issues, are works in progress as we move forward in a great experiment of a rich country and a poor country that are economically and culturally dependent.
What's public opinion like, Steve, in Mexico about this legalization question for something like marijuana in the United States? There are so many innocent people affected by the grave violence created by these cartels. Are average Mexicans open to the idea that the U.S. ought to legalize marijuana?
They are open. I think the sense on the street is more that why is this Mexico's problem? The demand is in the United States, and all of the emphasis seems to be on Mexico misbehaving. And over the years, sort of the certification of Mexico's drug interdiction efforts has been seen as sort of paternalistic when the real source of the problem is U.S. demand. And if that ended, then basically the cartel businesses would be dead. Really what's happening is a terrorizing of the Mexican people by the cartels, who are trying to turn around the government policy, the enforcement efforts there. The drug cartels have turned against the Mexican people to really say, is this what you want? Do you want blood on the streets, or do you want to return to the old days when the Mexican government let us do our thing? And the Mexican people weren't really affected by it. And if anything, the drug cartels sort of served as de facto governments in some jurisdictions. If you needed a loan, or if you needed financial help or medical care, you might go to the local cartel because they tend to have vast financial resources. That just tells you how many billions upon billions of dollars are at stake here. And despite interdiction and enforcement efforts for decades, there really hasn't been much of a shift in emphasis in terms of street quality, prices, or demand.
It's funny when you talk about cartel leaders serving as de facto governments and banks for the locals. It doesn't sound so different from shows we've done about Afghanistan and the Taliban controlling opium poppy production.
Exactly. And the United States briefly tried to, authorities in the U.S. briefly tried to tie the anti-terrorism sentiment after 9/11 and tried to sort of highlight the link, particularly in Afghanistan, between opium poppy production and terrorism and the linkages of those fundings, and try and turn that into sort of a moral moment in which U.S. drug dealers would say, I'm putting down the vial and the pipe and everything else because this is supporting terrorists somehow. But, you know, nobody ever ended up doing that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Jerry in McKinney. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, Chris. Wonderful guest today. I was curious. I have become, I don't want to say a conspiracy nut, but over time, it seems like, you know, we have an industry of building prisons. We have big business that is against hemp, legalizing marijuana, et cetera. Do you see any time in the future that we're going to deal with some of these immigration problems and drug legalization problems? I mean, I know a guy right now that can't go visit his dying father in Mexico because he's afraid he's going to get locked up either, you know, on trying to get back in.
It's ironic that when we ramped up border enforcement after 9/11, we actually kept migrant workers here because previously, if their work was seasonal, like in the fields, they would repeatedly go back and forth as the work was available. But now, because of the difficulties of crossing, you actually have more people here in the fringes. And I think before we reach the long-term solutions and we turn around the sort of prison industrial complex, the road that we seem to be going down, as you've suggested, I think we need compassion. I think we need to feel that the deaths on the border and that the deaths of innocent people in the Mexican drug cartel wars matter to us. And that imagine what our immigration policies would be like, for example, if we actually felt compassion toward migrants. And that's a lot of what the book tries to do, is to try and situate the virtue of even an undocumented migrant worker who's asking themselves, how far do I have to go to feed my kids? And wonder what our policies would be like if we truly felt compassion, which I will say, as a country, or at least the policymakers, we don't seem to have that compassion.
Do we need to examine our demand as a society for low-cost, undocumented Mexican labor when we, in the same way that we look at our demand for illicit drugs that come from Mexico?
I absolutely do think we do. I think, for example, taking one sector of low-income employment, and that is farm workers, we really don't appreciate the labor that it takes to put the food on our table. And in the farm industry, wages have just been stagnant. And I'm not saying they're just stagnant there. If you look at any industry in comparison to salaries of CEOs, you're going to look at some very stark dichotomies that have emerged over the years, as the middle class and the lower class has basically been stagnant in a Walmart economy where the rich get richer. And until we really appreciate those contributions and we fairly price food, and I'm afraid that's going to have to come from recognition of minimum wage laws, which are so politically unpopular. But until we do that, you know, we're going to be faced with an economy where workers can't viably support their families and where the jobs really can only be can only economically support an undocumented immigrant who's basically living tend to a house or under a porch or under the stars and sending what little money they can spare home. It's the way that economy runs.
Steve, why is it that with free trade, it is really easy to move capital, it is really easy to move legal trade goods across this border that we're talking about today, but it's really difficult to move labor?
Because it seems like we care more about goods than we do people, because otherwise NAFTA would have dramatically addressed the labor flows and labor consequences. Because frankly, one of the stark impacts of NAFTA was the U.S. farmers that were subsidized in the production of corn exported that corn to Mexico as a major market and put a lot of the Mexican corn farmers who didn't enjoy the same government subsidies out of business. And then with that sort of rural displacement, a lot of those workers went to the border factories to work. And if you've already been displaced and made it to the border and you look across the border and you say, well, I could make a few dollars an hour rather than a few dollars a day, are you going to try and cross the border? Many have, and the jobs are there.
And when you talk about the agriculture subsidies, it is actually cheaper in many Mexican markets to buy U.S.-produced produce than it is to buy things that are locally grown.
It is. Part of that is due to the sort of agribusiness, the benefits of efficiency, but a lot of it is due to subsidies that the Mexican farmers don't enjoy. And one way to address that is to look at NAFTA again and decide maybe NAFTA should be a labor pact as well, or maybe NAFTA should exclude some of these products that have really had a detrimental impact and really fostered undocumented immigration. Although at the same time, we seem to have found jobs in our bargain basement economies for a lot of these workers doing terrible, miserable work that U.S. residents don't seem to want to do, as borne out most recently, I think, by Georgia's experience when, in response to Georgia law, the farmers, you know, the farm economy basically dwindled and shrunk.
My guest is Stephen W. Bender. He's professor of law at Seattle University School of Law and author of the new book, Run for the Border, Vice and Virtue in U.S.-Mexico Border Crossings. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. Take more of your calls at 1-800-933-5372 and your emails to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Stephen W. Bender is my guest this hour. He's professor of law at Seattle University School of Law, and his latest book is called Run for the Border, Vice and Virtue in U.S.-Mexico Border Crossings. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Paul in Crowley. Hey, Paul.
Hi. I just love listening to Mr. Bender. He's the first person I've heard in ages that seems to know what's going on in Mexico. My brother and I own a bed and breakfast in Oaxaca, Mexico, where the farmers have been devastated by NAFTA and the corn that has been shipping down there. Because people are people. If they can buy cheap corn from here, they'll make their tortillas from that corn, not from the corn grown locally. The other thing is that I have one question and one more statement. We just built a new apartment onto our bed and breakfast, and we paid top dollar, $10 a day, and nobody can live on $10 a day anywhere that I know of. So, and my question is this: if Mexico thought of legalizing drugs a few years ago when we put the kibosh on it, they're thinking of it again. If that happens in Mexico, how will that affect things up here? And I'll listen to your answer. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Mexico has decriminalized personal quantities of drugs, but the real question is, and former President Fox threw this out recently, is legalizing production. And actually, Mexico operated for decades with, as I've suggested, the de facto legalization in exchange for bribes, sort of looking the other way as government enforcers. And so you really have the three models, which is the current model of thousands dying annually in the drug cartel wars with the federal government, or sort of the opposite approach of legalizing, decriminalizing both use and production and distribution of drugs. And then the middle ground that was the model that dominated for decades of the sort of corruption-based trafficking of drugs. And I'm saying in order to stop the bloodshed immediately, we've got to, in the short run, move away from the current model. And maybe the legalization model is the way to go, but I suggest that rather than proceed unilaterally, as Mexico does as often as the United States, there needs to be cross-border cooperation, recognizing the linkages between the two countries, and that some of these policies need to be worked out, particularly people and drugs, as we did with NAFTA and the form of commerce.
Compromise has come to be viewed as a dirty word in this country, at least in terms of Congress. Is it the same way when there are negotiations between Mexico and the United States with regard to aligning border enforcement policies to allow both sides to be safe and in control of who comes into their own countries?
Well, there's a good example that intersects labor as well during the Bracero program, which is it seemed on its face to be a cordial and path-breaking agreement between the United States and Mexico to serve labor in the U.S. fields in particular. But what happened is that when Mexico during lapses in the effectiveness of that accord was trying to negotiate higher wages, the United States would just basically open the borders and say, basically, everybody come on in. And, you know, that would subvert the negotiations. And so, if anything, the United States is going to get the labor it wants, even with government involvement, was illustrated by that episode. So even seeming cooperation doesn't seem to work out that way when the rubber hits the road.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Dan on the line now in Fort Worth. Hello, Dan.
Hey, I'm here.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Just back to the drug issue. What does your speaker, your guest, think about the idea, the marijuana that comes from Mexico, in my opinion, it's not the money and the type of marijuana. It's the harder drugs that have no legal purpose here is what we want to stop. Is the violence associated with which drug is what I'm getting at? What are the gangs really focused on as the drug of choice that makes the bang for the buck?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to separate because a number of the traffickers are across the board, and certainly if you're talking about methamphetamine and cocaine and heroin, there are trafficking routes that go through Mexico. They are not as significant as I mentioned a part of the financial wealth of the cartels, but nonetheless they are significant. And I have said, among other things, if we started with the decriminalization of marijuana, for example, drug enforcement could better emphasize the trafficking of some of the other drugs. Because, for example, heroin, the opium can only be grown in certain regions, so it's easier to focus on that. And methamphetamine can be more readily starved in terms of its core ingredients. And at the same time, we can take some of the money from a relatively benign drug like marijuana in the United States and take some of the money we spend toward enforcement and add to it some of the money we gain from taxation and really begin to address treatment issues on the U.S. streets, because it doesn't seem to matter it doesn't seem to matter the extent of drug interdiction and enforcement efforts. The demands of addicts tend to be the same. over time. So we really need to address those drugs that are really killing communities. And I elevate methamphetamine, as most studies have, as a drug that at least approaches or exceeds alcohol in what it extracts and imposes on local communities.
We have an email here that says, when you listen to TV news programs coming out of Mexico, you hear people saying basically stop the violence. They don't say eliminate the cartels. They say stop the violence, as though the cartels are okay as long as cartels and federal police don't create violence. And the emailer asks, am I hearing this correctly?
Potentially so, because there's that long history, again, of the cartels really operating as close to legitimate businessmen as you might imagine. And given that history, there is a substantial sentiment of return to that. These people weren't bringing drugs to the streets of Mexico. They were bringing it to the gringo in the United States, who seems to want it. And that was making a lot of money for them, and they weren't really killing anybody, because there was really no reason to. And part of the cost was certainly greasing the palms of the Mexican government, but all that seemed to operate without blood on the streets. And so I'm sure that's being heard correctly. There is a substantial sentiment that will probably get reflected in the election this year in Mexico, as Calderon is term limited out this year.
An email here from Matt in Plano asks, if you could change one thing in U.S. immigration policies, what would that be?
I think I would interject compassion, and I would return us more to the good neighbor policy that prevailed before 1965, in which we really didn't have fixed immigration limits from Mexico, and we realized that jobs have really been what have drawn Mexicans across the border. And when jobs exist, they come. When they don't, like today, the Border Patrol people have much less to do. And so I think a return to that immigration policy that predated 1965's legislative change, where we recognized that other countries in the Western Hemisphere were linked economically, culturally, socially, and we didn't have these artificial limits that overnight were far lower than labor demand. And so people say, get to the end of the labor line or get to the end of the immigration line, as if there's some line that ultimately is going to succeed, when the numbers are very, very small for low-skilled labor. It's basically non-existent in terms of a lawful path to immigration. So what do people do? I think we wink and nod and say, you know, amigo, make it across the border if you can survive. But leave your family behind and live in the shadows and do our worst, most miserable jobs. And if we catch you, then all bets are off. We don't know you, and you violated the law being here, so get out. That's really the system we operate under.
Is there any country on the planet, though, that fully opens its borders and says to all who want to move here, come on over?
You know, the irony is that Mexico has sort of the same border front with Central American countries.
Right.
And how Mexico posits things is that, look, for the number of Mexicans that are crossing the U.S. border, we've got the same number of Central Americans crossing the Mexican border. And
they're no happier about it, I should interject.
They're no happier about it, sure. I mean, xenophobia is evident everywhere. I think borders are something that we have to address, I'm suggesting, hemispherically.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other grounds in which we can address it. We certainly seem to have we have the luxury of traveling across state lines as if they don't exist in the United States. But we put all this focus on the U.S. border, especially in Texas. I'm happy to be talking to you because you have over 1,200 miles of that border, over half of it. With Mexico, and that's in the U.S.-Mexico border, despite my proximity to the Canadian border, is really where immigration policies are about. If you're talking about the front lines of border policies in the United States, you're talking about the U.S.-Mexico border.
talk a little bit about this. We are now reproducing at lower than the replacement rate in this country.
Yeah, demographics. It's interesting because I was giving a talk in Victoria, British Columbia the other day, and the headline of the newspaper was talking about how Canada's population is aging, and demographics foretell that Canada needs about 1 million immediately immigrant workers, or really the sustainability of their economy is in jeopardy. And I've long said that in the United States, with an aging Anglo population that needs Social Security and needs entry-level home buyers and needs workers to compete with global economies like India and China, that we may be someday, particularly with the decline in the Mexican birth rate in Mexico, we may be advertising with signs at the border not saying stay out, but please come in. We've got jobs for you and we need you.
Let's quickly take a final call here. We have Julie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Julie.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Thanks. My question is, as these issues continue to boil in our border, what websites or news media or interest groups can people follow to stay updated? I'm particularly interested in the issues of legalizing marijuana and reducing the amount of people who are incarcerated for marijuana without treatment.
Any suggestions, Steve?
I cite a number of authorities in my book, in the footnotes. There's so many in this internet society these days. What I think is most difficult, both on the drug side and the immigration side, is there are so many myths that are out there and how to separate really fact from fiction. And that's really what I've dedicated my books to trying to do, is to try and state, sort of a calm, compassionate view of facts. And that's what I really need to be doing as a scholar, is I can't get caught up in emotion. I really have to sort of look and weigh all the evidence. And I can say that more than most other areas, immigration and drug policy is just surrounded by so many myths. In the case of drugs, we can only go back to, you know, to say the 1930s or so, and reefer madness, and the impression that somehow, you know, you smoke a joint and you're out with an axe on the streets committing mayhem, and bloody mayhem. And the irony is that the only way that really happens is not the users, it's the cartels in Mexico trying to survive. And I'm saying, let's shut all that violence down.
Stephen W. Bender is professor of law at Seattle University School of Law. His newest book is called Run for the Border, Vice and Virtue in U.S.-Mexico Border Crossings. Steve, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Great. Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast, all at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.